Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
You're in the madhouse now.
The Homance Chronicles.
The female equivalent of a bromance.
So many poor choices.
But so many good takes.
But so many poor choices.
All right. Well, this is the Homance Chronicles. Forever tired. This is Sarah.
I'm Nicole. I have a foot massager going right now. So if you hear any weird, like, behind me noise of just...
It's not the vibrator. Okay, got it.
Which, no, it's not on high enough speed for a vibrator.
Would I be offended or honored? I think I'd be honored. Unless you... Well, yeah, honored. I'm going with that.
My feet are freezing and I have this under the desk foot massager that's also heated. Now, you could only turn on the heat if that's what you so chose to do. However,
who would ever want that without the massage component? Like,
why would you do that?
Unless my feet are very sore from rigorous massaging earlier in the day, please give me all.
So I just assume that you can't hear it because it's muffled by my actual feet.
And that amazing microphone you have in front of you.
Right.
That's awesome. But yeah.
This is where we're at. This is what you do when you're 40. You're like, you know what? I barely pulled myself together to be on this call with you. And in order to sustain this call, I have to have a foot massager with heat on.
Hello. Adding to my already need for a blanket and or heat thing in general. Just a space heater in general.
Craziness.
Yeah, I agree. It's remarkable the amount of getting ready I don't do anymore post-COVID. Like, never in a million years would anybody I worked with be able to see me like this yet. Today and every other day, this is how I operate anymore. Just this, which is not appealing in any way, shape, or form. Just really goes to show that my work is really outshining me as a person.
Yeah. I mean, used to actually put, like, you know, full face of makeup on every day to go to work. And the only thing that I run out of is my, like, stick concealer.
Yeah. I haven't run out of that since fucking beginning of last year. I got to re-up before it runs out so it doesn't make my face all cucka because it's got cucka in it. Which reminds me,
I look at some of
my
makeup and I'm just like, oh my God, how old is this?
Yeah. I'm at that stage too where I'm like, if I haven't touched you in a year, you're just going to go in the trash. My makeup drawer is going to get really thin really quickly. Kind of sad, but here we are doing it.
Yeah. So, you know, I've got a couple of zits covered with my concealer stick. Mm-hmm. And
that's more than me.
You know, this very luxurious hoodie.
Trust me, my work people have seen it all. But anyway, let's get into it. Are you ready? You ready for this, lady?
I'm ready. Who's your hoe of history?
Well, you sent her over yesterday, day before, last week, maybe. I don't remember. All the days are merging together.
Yeah.
It was probably Monday number 6 or 7 in the week of Mondays that we have all day, every
right.
day.
Well, and it was funny because on the graphic for the last episode on Betty White, you put episode 626.
Oh, that's cute.
it was 600, or it was 262. And, So, I don't expect you to know what day you received that message from me.
Or We're just here. We're trying. I like how you're the only person that called me out on that. You didn't even care enough to call me out when it was posted. I didn't notice until you just said something. They get it. Our people get it.
I don't think anybody's that worried about it.
No, if they even look at it, honestly. All right. But yeah, so today, our hoe is Alma de Bretville Spreckles, a.k.a. Big Alma, a.k.a. the great-grandmother of San Francisco. Wee, wee, wee. Wee, wee. So I'm trying to downsize you here so that we can still hang out. I can still look at you while I chat at you. Okay. So she was born in San Francisco, but like when San Francisco still had farms. So she was born on a farm in San Francisco. She was born March 24, 1881. She was born Alma Charlotte Corday Le Normand de Bretville in the Sunset District. She was fifth of six children to Vigo and Matilda de Bretville. They were two Danish immigrants who came over. The dad came from wealth, it turns out. His grandfather came from Danish nobility. And so he, through the French Revolution, and he absolutely loved to tell people and everybody else that they had royal heritage. Like, they were royalty, they had wealth because they were born into it, yada, yada, yada. And per the pattern we know, he used that as an excuse to avoid doing actual work. So he would tout that he came from wealth, but they were quickly running out of cash. And he would also judge those who came to San Francisco and came into their own wealth due to the gold rush. He would say they didn't deserve it. Like, what? So you come from royalty. You don't know how to work a day in your life. And then you're going to dog people who know what they're doing to make themselves money. All right. Cool.
He thought that just like nepotism is the way of life. That's the only way.
Yes, essentially. So while he continued to like put his nose up at the people who put their shit to work, were on the grind, his wife realized they were going to get fucked over pretty quickly. So she took up the reins and decided to move the family to downtown, to a flat, and opened up a Danish bakery, laundry service, and a massage parlor. So it was, it was one business, but then it quickly turned into three separate businesses that they worked on. And it was their primary source of income. So it could have been an all-in-one business, but it also could have been three separate businesses that they ran at once. And by 14, though, Alma's dad instructed her to quit going to school so she could start working for the family full-time so that they could make money. Because his veggie sales weren't really up.
Veggie sales? I thought that they were, you said massage parlor.
Yeah, and no, he had a number of jobs as a vegetable salesman, et cetera, at one point, but all of them didn't pan out as according to our pattern. You know, failed businesses. Okay, so yes, she did quit public school. However, she was very interested in the arts and some sciences, I guess. So she ended up taking up night classes at the Mark Hopkins Institute of Art to study painting mostly. So while she was there, she was in her like late teens, and she basically started to come into her beauty. So people started to take note of her beauty and asked for her to be a model, a sitting model for the artists. Well, eventually she realized, hey, I could make a lot of cash from doing this. And so she would start to accept offers from the local artists to pose nude. And many of her nudes paintings that were tastefully painted, giving these air marks because I don't know for sure, but they ended up finding their ways around to all the infamous cocktail bars that were on the cocktail route. That was a place back then. Okay. So she was in the bars as a, you know, unnamed lady of sorts, While she was doing this, she ended up attracting a miner named Charlie Anderson. And let's see, he was roughly 40 something, and she was in her early teen or late teens. They only spent about 5 weeks with each other, and he did make a fortune gold mining in Alaska. So here's one of my, I'm going to read snippets from the sfgate.com article that I found, because it is going to show us exactly how how Alma kind of like did this guy in. It was pretty, it's pretty great. So in February of 1902, they're at court in San Francisco. She was suing him, I should start off with. He was a millionaire. They were dating for about 5 weeks. He broke it off, and she was like, oh, no, suing you for false promises and deflowerization.
Oh,
if you will.
Oh.
For personal deflowering. So of course,
so he's in his 40s,
and she was in her late teens. And
what a creep. He deserved it.
Yeah, absolutely. So she essentially was like, I'm suing you. So the newspaper caught wind, and everyone was like, oh, this is great, the tea. So of course it became like big news. When they were going to the court case, there was a lot of onlookers, like super curious as to what was going to go on. So she was, oh, I'm sorry. She was 20 years old at the time. She was still an art student. And essentially she was like waiting to drop the hammer on this guy.
Okay. They had if she's 20, I can't.
No, but still like 40 something and a 20 something. It's still gross. Yeah. Still grosses me out.
I mean, there's some coercion, I would believe, in the deflowering.
Yeah.
If 100%. She was still a virgin.
We don't know for sure.
But if they only dated for 5 weeks.
Yeah.
She was a virgin, like, I don't know. I mean, he might have very well made some promises.
Oh, well, listen. So after a whirlwind romance that didn't end in matrimony, de Bretville was accusing Anderson of breaching his promise to marry her. She was a woman scorned and sought $50,000 in restitution fees for having her good name besmirched.
Okay.
She says, he told me he wished me to become his wife, and I promised to become his wife. However, throughout the course of their romance, Anderson gifted her with lavish garments, furs, and spent cash on her many occasions over. She was treated to stiff cocktails and decadent luncheons at the Cliff House, among other prominent restaurants of the time. The de Bretville family also benefited from the courtship, as they enjoyed the $60 opera box Anderson secured for them. However, Anderson grew resentful of the young woman's desire for material goods. He told the court, and so he decided to cut the entire family off cold turkey. He never imagined it would land him in court months later. He says, I spent about 5 weeks with her, and it cost me $1,500, bitterly. So begins the story of Alma. She became one of the most prominent philanthropists in San Francisco. And this was
Wait,
kind of
well,
like,
did she win, though?
Oh, yeah. It's yeah. So this was the pinnacle turning point for Big Alma.
So she actually won.
Yep. So she won the case against Anderson and was awarded a sum of $2,550, about $43,000 in damages. It was then known as the Heartbalm suit. And it wasn't uncommon in the 1900s when women could successfully win lawsuits if they could prove they were swindled out of the engagement. The implication of failed engagement was sometimes that the woman was no longer a virgin. If a couple had premarital sex without eventually walking down the aisle, a woman's social standing could forever be ruined. Conversely, the man could carry on scot-free. So back in the courtroom, she told jurors that Anderson grumbled about how much he'd spend on her, but also once threatened to end his life if she ever left his side. He had a different
for heaven's sake.
Oh, yeah. He had a different recollection. It was an assertion that she pursued him even when it came to their first kiss. He told jurors that while they were on a drive, she leaned in to steal a kiss. which he said caught him by surprise. The second time she kissed him, Anderson contended he couldn't avoid her advances because she was 6 feet tall, a towering figure compared to him. She was so tall, he says, she just stooped down and kissed me and then straightened up again. Despite gifts and kisses, Anderson staunchly denied that he ever intended to marry her, even after he bought her a pricey $375 Marques ring. He alleged that he had a problem saying no and only agreed to buy it after she gave him no peace until he did. So, of course, he's sitting here framing her as the naggy female who wants, wants, wants. But reality, she was chased down by him. So when he gave it to her, she put it on her finger and holding it up to the light in a transport of joy said, ain't it grand? It ought to be. It costs enough, he said. Years later, she looked back on the trial rather pleased on it, that it was the time I sued for personal defloweration by God, I won. So maybe she was a virgin. Probably was. I don't know. But yeah, so it's... She essentially was like, given they gave her background of she was born and raised, she dropped out of school at 14 to help her mom run the laundry business, which also housed a bakery and massage parlor. Okay, so it was a combo move. Let's see. So that is kind of like the end of the Charlie Anderson debacle, if you will. She won. She made money off of this asshole.
Okay. And did you check to see how much amount of money would be in today's?
Yeah, it was about $43,000.
Okay. So what she actually won was what? 25?
Yep.
You said 25, 50. So she won $2,500, which in today's money is.
Oh, I'm sorry. $1,250. Which is about $43,000 in today's current.
Okay. All right. Because, like, initially, you were saying that she was suing him for, like, $48,000 or something. But I didn't realize that that was, like, today's money. And I was $48,000 in the 1900s. I'm like, Jesus, she won that?
Yeah. Well, yes, kind of.
But yes, but it wasn't actually. It was.
No.
But it was around $2,000.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so like I said earlier, this kind of secured her celebrity status in San Francisco as like a ballsy chick, and she never really left San Francisco. She was always in and out of the city. So she's also the model for a famous sculpture, Robert Atkins sculpted for the Dewey Monument. And it's still standing in the Union Square today, like in San Francisco Union Square. Some people think it was a different model. Some people think it was Alma. There's really no clear cut who it was. So she was also like identified as, oh, she's kind of a floozy because she's a artist's model and she does nudes and all that fun stuff. So they tried to shit on her and could not the whole time.
Okay.
Okay.
So was she really 6 foot?
Yeah, she was a tall lady.
Okay, that is pretty tall.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I guess I like think back to earlier days and for some reason feel like people were smaller.
Little Women always confirmed that women should be 5 feet or less in those era. I don't know why.
But you even think about like the sizes of clothing and stuff and you see like women, even from like the 50s who like first started wearing two-piece bathing suits and their waists are like tiny. So the way that we know sizes today is not the same as what sizes were back then. And so like in my head, I'm like, there's no 6 foot woman back then.
Right. But,
of course there is. Of course there is. Why would I, what's wrong with me?
I don't know. It's just the depiction of the times in your brain.
Right.
Like I said, Little Women. That's all I got.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the sculpture almost actually didn't make it to Union Square. Actually, if it wasn't for Adolf Spreckels and his insisting that statue, because it was entered into a contest, his insistence that statue be put into Union Square, it actually never would have been. And He ended up like courting her for about 5 years, even though he was 24 years older than she was. He was absolutely smitten. And so after 5 years of dating, they actually got married on May 11th, 1908. So he was actually the head of Spreckels Sugar Company. And this is, and this is where.
But why? Why again? 24 years older than her. Like,
she was a spitfire, apparently.
But still, I mean, what is it with men? Because it still happens today. I mean, you see it with like celebrity men, right? Like the latest is like Bradley Cooper and Gigi Hadid, right?
Oh, God, yeah.
And you're like, how do you even have anything in common?
You don't.
You're 25 years apart.
I don't know. Maybe back then it was different, but really you don't. It doesn't matter the era. You all go through shit differently and at your different stages in your life when you're at those different ages. So I really can't justify it. However, they're in love. Absolutely okay. Smitten and in love. So this is where the term sugar daddy was born.
Yes, this is what I sent you, was the brief reel on the background of sugar daddy.
Yeah. So she would tell people that he was her sugar daddy because he was the actual head of a sugar company. And he was old enough to be her dad. Oh, Alma, you're such a knee slapper. At first, when they were wed, they lived together in his house in Salcedo, where she actually had their first daughter. He soon purchased more property in Pacific Heights. He actually had the homes on that property relocated, and he erected a new mansion called the Spreckels Mansion, which was completed in 1912. They did have three children total, two daughters and a son. However, I could not find anything about the third daughter, the third child, aka their daughter. So we're only going to be talking about his two, son and daughter. In 1911, their first child, Adolf Bernard Jr., was born. And then their daughter, Dorothy Constance, was born in 1913. It wasn't until after the birth of their daughters that she found out, Alma found out that Mr. Alma, had actually
contracted... Mr. Alma, you mean Alfred?
Yes, him. He actually contracted syphilis before their marriage, and it was starting to finally show. It is said that he was hesitant to marry her due to that. He didn't actually want to tell her or scare her away, but he also didn't want to marry her for fear that, you know, something bad would happen. However, he was in remission the entire time they were together for their marriage, so he never actually passed it to her or their children.
Well, that's lucky. I mean, they dated for 5 years before they got married, so yeah.
And then they got married and had children, so she's very lucky. At that point, I believe they kind of stopped their sexual engagement in their marriage, which she was fine with because she definitely had to start focusing on the fact that they had three children. And she was trying to kind of like elevate the Spreckels name through like highfalutin meetings and all sorts of fun parties and stuff. And
she was like, there's no possible way that I can have a sex life and do this.
Exactly. Girl, I get it. So she would actually host parties. This was pre-mansion. So she would actually, like, before they had the mansion as a place for people to gather, she would try to host, you know, parties for influentials to join. But many would see her as like an imposter because of her humble beginnings. So once the mansion was actually finished, the attendees started to attend her more opulent parties. And this pretty much encouraged her to kind of like continue to try and climb the social ladder a little bit. So as one does, in 1914, she flew to Paris. By flew, I mean took a boat. Probably took her months. Who knows? The intent there was to purchase furniture from the 18th century to start to like continue to decorate this lavish home that was built for her. Instead, while she was there, she met Loie Fuller, who was actually famous for her serpentine dancing. She was from Illinois, hanging out in Paris, kind of doing her thing. She'll be another hoe in the future because she was sassy. And Alma, like, basically clung to her. And Loie basically felt the same about Alma. They were kind of best of friends right off the rip. And at this point in time, she was over in Paris. The First World War was getting ready to break out. However, while she was there, she spent a lot of time with her learning about the scene, the culture, the different players in the game, primarily in the sculpture arena, as that's kind of where she got her humble beginnings from. But she was introduced at that time to several sculptors, including August Rodin and some others that were pretty famous and influential. She came back from Paris right at the beginning of WWI and was able to work with Loie and a lot of persistence, work out a deal to purchase about 13 sculptures from Arthur Putnam, who was doing metal bronze sculptures at the time. And she was like a regular business customer of his after she was able to secure, she was able to secure all of these sculptures, drawings, etc. She would keep going back. And this basically kind of kicked her off as like one of the most influential and important art collectors in the San Francisco era at that time. Like, she was incredibly important for a lot of different reasons in that venue or in that
regard. So, I mean, besides having this artwork for her own viewing purposes and for being able to show off that she's, I don't know, privileged or whatever. I mean, was the thought here that it was going to draw attention or like draw validity or...
So she was actually very philanthropic and turned the art collection into opportunities for philanthropy. She came back, she purchased all of these works as well as some drawings and paintings. And she ended up premiering them in the San Francisco at the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915. So there was an art show that showed up that had works from all different areas, including international. So it was like a, you know, an art fair, but at a grand scale. She absolutely fell in love with the French Pavilion that was actually a replica of the, I can't remember what the name of it is. I don't know if I put it in here. So she fell in love with it, absolutely had to have it. So at that point, she decided she must build a museum of equal beauty to house all of her purchases from everybody that she had in her collection. And so that's basically when it started. However, it didn't come to fruition for a while. So while she was trying to figure out how to get the building ready or how to get her museum built, how to fund it, she started to host charity auctions to raise money for war-torn countries like France, Belgium, and Romania. Her house at 2080 Washington had a 5-limousine garage, and that was constantly filled up for garage sales. So she immediately started collecting things to either sell or salvage. She had
garage sales.
Yeah.
I mean, every time she's buying something, she's selling something.
Right. Like,
it's a constant rotation.
Well, she wasn't doing garage sales of her work, actually. She was doing basically like supplies for survival and soldiers and stuff like that. So it wasn't like she was selling her artwork at the time. She was selling goods to create financing for things, but also she was collecting supplies for everything. So it was like the five limousine garage was like a store, basically. It had multiple functions in it there.
I'm just picturing walls and walls of sugar.
Yeah, right. She had also been trying to host a highly publicized raffle at the Palace Hotel. She made such a name for herself that she actually was able to obtain donations from U.S. presidents and others from a lot around the world that were in the arts and sciences. And she even auctioned off one of her favorite pieces from Rodin, The Genius of War. She was eventually able to convince her husband to fund the Spreckels Museum. And in order to gain more financial support, she went back to Europe.
Every story that we do, the woman ends up in Europe at some point in time. I didn't mention it on her first trip. Now that she's taking a second one, I feel like just for continuity.
Yeah.
I need to say in every episode.
In every episode. She goes back to Europe, and the work she did for the French, Belgian, and other areas of Europe was actually recognized. She went and kind of said, hey, I'm trying to create a museum to mimic the French pavilion at this event. And while she was talking to them about that, she also got them to agree to supply some financing for her museum. Her good friend Loie was good friends with Queen Marie of Romania, and she donated a replica of her Byzantine golden room. Also, fun side quest, while she was in Europe, President Warren G. Harding actually compelled her to help in compiling a report on post-war working conditions for women for the Department of Labor's Women's Bureau. And she absolutely carried out that duty, no questions asked. So when she came back, she not only had to report to the President of the United States, but she also had some pretty epic wins from the French government as well as the Queen of Romania. So, like, philanthropy.
But, I mean, okay, so she's got all these high power connections, and is not necessarily in a sense of reality or for like the everyday person. But the president's asking her to talk about job opportunities for women after the war. Miss Ma'am is not your everyday.
No. But she did come from humble beginnings, Nicole.
I mean, I don't doubt that she could do the job. I'm just like, okay, I'm curious as to what she listed, because her world is very different from most women.
Yes, apples and oranges. But she never forgot where she came from. She's still Jenny from the block. All right. In 1921, she was able to finally break ground for the museum. She worked with her architect, George Applegarth, and it was set to be located in Lincoln Park. She got approval from the French government to build the 3/4 scale replica of the French pavilion of Palace of the Legion in honor of Paris from the French government, because they own the rights or whatever. It took roughly 3 to 5 years to get the museum built. And at the grand opening ceremony, her husband didn't make it because he actually passed 6 months earlier from pneumonia. And she was absolutely heartbroken about it. It didn't matter that during the dedication, the Counselor of State of France announced Spreckels had been awarded the Grand Cross of the Legion d'Honneur, which is a pretty high up honor. So yeah, like I said, she was absolutely devastated that Adolf had passed away. She absolutely adored him, and he adored her. He was one of the only people who could really keep up with her high energy, bunch of ideas, and still loved her through everything. So she was really super bummed. She ended up at that point being the richest widow in the West. So she had around, at her peak, around $14 million, which is a lot.
Yeah.
Back then.
Today, too.
Also today. Yes, actually, it would still do quite a bit of damage if I had $14 million. All right. At this stage, she was in like the jazz age. She ended up liquidating some of her business holdings, including the steamship company, as well as two newspapers, the San Diego Union and Tribune. From that, she managed a very comfortable life and had no wants at all. And this kind of continued from that point into the late 1920s. And so she was really at that stage, was living her best life, raising her kids. She was moving between properties from Washington to France with her children. She was dealing with remodels and all this, all the likes, all the rich people shit that rich people do, but also trying to raise her children who were incredibly spoiled. She had to deal with mood swings, travels, her, they said, highly demanding children, a full social life that included high stakes poker games with celebrity elites. And she was able still to do her philanthropic work. So at this point, we're approaching the Great Depression. She would then continue to host rummage sales, which expanded into salvage shops. Those are eventually given to the Salvation Army to fully administer and operate. I didn't dive into it, but I think she might be the reason Salvation Army has actual stores for people to go and shop from today. So,
Interesting.
yes. So she was absolutely play hard, but also give back hard. She continued to collect more art for the museum, as well as contributing to many things along the way. She, like I said, was redecorating her various estates. She would host celebrities like Bing Crosby, Charlie Chaplin, John Barrymore, and more at her estate in Sonoma. She spent huge money on her daughter Dorothy for her coming out party. So I guess that her daughter was, gay. And she was like, fuck it, we're gonna host a rager for you to come out and be gay.
That's
And
what
it
they
was
called it
like
back then, though?
her coming out party.
Yeah.
I don't, yeah. This is what I'm not real sure with. And again, I didn't dive super deep into it because I was like,
I don't.
I got enough going
That.
on. But that's what that was what they noted as her coming out party. So I don't know. Maybe she was ready
I
to
don't
get
know if.
married. I don't
I was gonna say, I don't
know.
know if that simply means, though, that she was gay and that it's the same. Meaning that we have today.
I know you're going to do some investigatory, so I'll keep going while you're doing that because I see you tapping away over there.
Well, I am. I'm gonna try to without slowing down my whole computer.
I feel
I'm not
that.
promising any
No, you're good.
results because I don't
You're
wanna
good.
have a Zoom lapse here.
Yeah. So again, while she was doing all this partying, she was still very much a philanthropist and ended up contributing to the development of Mary Hill Museum of Art in Maryhill, Washington, which was huge for those folks over there. They were, if it wasn't for her, they wouldn't have established it. Okay, so around the time she was 56, she met her second husband, Elmer All, and everybody dubbed him Uncle Elmer. He was 47, so she married younger this time around. He was a flamboyant life of the party rancher and businessman man from Santa Barbara who co-funded the Rancheros Vistadores in 1929. And this establishment or organization was known for their annual chuck wagon camping trips, which was actually like a real kitschy celebrity to do. Like it was mostly a like adventure type thing. So they would do like, chuck wagons celebrities would come, get on the wagons, and they'd really feel knew what it was like to be a country count, or you know, a cowboy in the old West there.
Well, just so you know, a coming out party from the 1930s is more like a debutante ball.
Okay.
And it's like connecting your
she's ready to get married. Yep.
Single daughter with the most eligible bachelors. And there's even a movie from 1934 called Coming Out Party.
See?
So I was like, I don't know. Don't think that that means the same thing.
I'm glad
and
that you did that.
She would have been way, way, way progressive.
Right. Well, I mean, she was a progressive century. Lady, so I wasn't sure. And I clearly made the guess and I was wrong. So thank you.
Yeah, it's more just like putting your daughter on display.
Ew.
I mean, it's rich people arranged marriage.
Right. Debutante balls. Got it.
Yeah.
Will still happen. It's fine.
It was just funny. I was like, I don't think I can let this one go.
I'm fine with that. I figured that would be the case. Okay. She met him while she was in Santa Barbara looking at a hotel that was Persian themed, but it like fell to the wayside and it was such a money pit and needed a bunch of shit. And she was like, okay, I'm going to take this and rehabilitate it and turn it into something that I can start putting my art collection in. So like another essentially museum of sorts. And that was in 1937 is when they started doing that. Yeah. So they hit it off immediately and married in 1939. He went from Santa Barbara to San Francisco for a while. Some say she grew bored of him. Others say it's because of the property they purchased. It wasn't doing so well. She actually ended up sending him back to Santa Barbara. And because the business wasn't doing so well, and they ended up not being able to really contain the hotel anymore. They couldn't even find a buyer for it. So they ended up trading it for a dairy farm in Marion County instead of selling it. Like, could you imagine? Here, take this dilapidated Persian themed hotel we couldn't renovate and I'll take your dairy farm. Thank you. Just a flat trade.
It's so bizarre.
Also, the dairy farm was worth $80,000. So,
but then what does the dairy farm do with the hotel if she can't even do anything with it?
Well, I don't know. They didn't mention anything about it afterwards. They just got the farm and that was that.
So I'm like, so what does a dairy farmer do with it now?
Who knows? Who knows? Sit and cry in it?
Okay.
Okay. So her new man was actually in the Coast Guard Reserve and World War II was right there. He was called to active duty. Again, she jumped in with her charity pants on. Formed a new charity called the San Francisco League for Servicemen and gathered Army and Navy supplies for everybody. Again, she returned her garage into a recycling center this time. She also donated her Sorba Vista to the Army as a recreational center. So she like donated one of her full establishments to them. As the war was nearing the end, however, she found that her husband was cheating on her with her niece and private assistant, Ula. You whore.
Oh my goodness.
I know. So she divorced him promptly in 1943. However, when he did come home, he and Ola got married and settled in Santa Barbara. So I believe they were married for the whole time. Good for them.
Hmm. But I mean, quite the betrayal. Your
absolutely.
Niece.
Absolutely. And yes, so I have to imagine in Sarah's world, it was a correspondence thing that quickly turned into a love affair. Okay, moving to the 1950s. So she's still doing philanthropic work. She's still managing life, et cetera, et cetera. So the San Francisco Maritime Museum started solely with her collection as the core of how it started. And as it got up and running, Carl Cortum, who was one of the co-founders, he actually got into like a tiff with her over the lack of recognition for her efforts and contributions to get the museum up and running. Her, like I said, the first collection ever showcased was it from her personal collection. And she was hugely involved, but never really got the recognition she wanted. So she was pissy with him about that. I don't know whatever came of that. The museum continued. So she, like I said, had three children. And one of her daughters, we don't know what happened to her. Her other daughter had a coming out party. And her son, Adolf Jr., he ended up, unfortunately, passing of a heart attack in 1961. So as it was written, he was the quintessential spoiled rich kid. He drank in excess. He pursued women endlessly and more than likely did drugs a lot.
Yeah.
He ended up marrying and divorcing six different women in his lifetime, and he had a very violent temper. She was really bummed. He became kind of a great disappointment for her, as she really wanted him to be like an upstanding citizen and kind of fill in her shoes, if you will, like walk in her path.
Yeah, I mean, at bare minimum, I think most mothers want their children to be productive members of society.
Yeah, bare minimum for sure. She didn't even get that.
No, I know. That's why I'm like, well, you know, you'd think that he would be hopeful in her eyes of being able to continue on with her businesses or philanthropic things and turning them into businesses or whatever, because she clearly married off her daughters. Right. So, was disappointing on many fronts.
Many, many fronts. And she was like devastated. She almost
felt guilty because she was gallivanting in Paris while he was a child.
No, she didn't feel guilty about that. She felt guilty that she didn't provide him with like more structure and not being firm enough with him as a child. Like she was definitely in his life a lot more than most of the women that we've talked about, but it just wasn't identified here as like she was with them all day, every day. So at the end of her lifetime, she basically spent her in near seclusion. She would start her days with a nude swim in her swimming pool in her backyard. She would read mystery novels and then eventually took up visiting her daughters and her six grandchildren as often as she possibly could. So remember when I said she started off with $14 million? By the time she passed away in 1968 at the age of 87, she had all but $1 million in her property at 2040 Washington left in her name.
That's the way to do it, though.
Right. Well, she then dispersed this with everybody left, daughters and grandchildren-wise, so everybody got joint ownership of everything.
No, I think she did it perfectly. If I had $14 million... I would also pace it out so that when I died, there wouldn't be a shit ton of money left over and whatever was left would go to my loved ones.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
I mean, $1 million when everything was all said and done to be left over, plus whatever her properties and artwork and all that other stuff, and to be split amongst the two daughters' families. Like, to me, I'm like, that sounds like it all washed out nicely.
Yeah. And don't forget, her property at 2080 Washington had a 5-limo garage.
I know. Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm sure that they were able to, like, sell some of the properties or whatever they needed to do.
But she didn't. Like, that was all she had at the end of it. I don't know what happened to any of it.
No, I'm saying, like, her daughters or whatever, if they wanted to, they could have, like, sold
the one property she
the property on. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know if she gave her shit away, if she liquidated it for more money. There's not a lot of information on that. But that's it.
I wonder if she was proud, maybe not the right word. I don't know. I'm trying to find the right word for like how you would feel about sugar daddy becoming a term.
Oh,
and it's sticking.
I feel like Alma was probably okay with that. She was a little bit of a jokester, if you will.
Yeah, so I'm like, she had a good sense of humor, so she probably thought it was hilarious that it stuck.
Had to have.
Right?
Had to have. I mean, I hope so. I do. I really do. Yeah, so that is Big Alma. The greatest philanthropic art collector from San Francisco there ever was. I'm making that up.
Yeah. I was like, well, I don't know if we can give her that title, but okay.
That's us. It's fine. Nobody takes it for written in stone anyway. It's cool.
I mean, you got to give her some substance in addition to the coiner of sugar daddy terms.
And the first woman to like really marked pretty well, made headlines for suing the man.
Right, for defloweration. Yeah.
Personal defloweration.
Yeah. She was like, this motherfucker lied. Mm-mm-mm.
He ain't it. It ain't it. I just love the contrast in, you know, recollections.
Right.
I bought them everything. I had to cut them off. I had to do this. He said he wanted to be my husband. I wanted to be his wife. And then he stole my virginity. So fuck him.
Yes. Oh, wow. What a time.
So, yeah.
What a story.
Right? Indeed. Indeed.
Good job.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, there wasn't like, there were different spins, but ultimately everything was kind of the same story. There are obviously things in pop culture around her and her story. There was a book called The Sorcery Club, and it was a tale of the occult, largely set in San Francisco. And Alma does make an appearance in chapters, what is it, 7? 6 is Ella Crockford, the wife of the California Street Sugar King, and is blackmailed for various entertaining but some disreputable what?
I'm like, what are you trying to say?
Disreputable.
Okay.
they kind of painted her as a sassy, saucy so and so in that book. So I have to imagine like she was just sass posture through and through.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for looking into her and making us aware.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for listening and participating in the coming out this definition.
Yeah, I'm like, I feel like in the 30s that they didn't even really say the word gay unless you meant happy. It wasn't like a term about people. And so I'm like, I don't think that they're sitting here having parties for homosexuals.
Probably not.
So, sorry, I had to bust your myth.
No, I'm fine with that. I'm okay with that.
Well, I guess it's Atta Girl time.
It is. It is Atta Girl time.
Atta Girls are where we pat ourselves on the back for something good that we did or something good that's happened to us. And my Atta Girl this week is that I finally found a cleaning product that would get rid of the like hard water stains in my tub.
Oh.
And I proceeded then to get so much enjoyment out of like watching the stains go away. I scrubbed it for probably like a half an hour.
Oh, wow. So how did it work? How did it pan out?
So I don't know if the bathtub in my bathroom is the original bathtub, but it's definitely not new by any means. And it probably needs to be like reglazed or something at some point, but it's very porous. And so it holds on to like the water stains and stuff. Like I've used Tilex, CLR, Comet, like things with bleach, things without bleach, magic erasers, whatever, right? So I found this cleaning stuff called the Pink Stuff. And it's the Pink Stuff comes in a like squirt bottle or I don't know, various other ways that you can apply it. But I got like this little tub And so I just like took a sponge and grabbed it out of the tub like it was putty, basically. And I didn't even have to press hard. And I was just like watching it like disappear. It was, like seeing an infomercial on TV that you don't believe, you know? It was very satisfying. And then I like, after I'm done scrubbing it, because who knows how long like some of these like stains and stuff, like some of them might have been there before I even bought the house, right? Like, I mean, I've tried everything with this tub. So I like back away and I'm just staring at it. And I'm like, oh my God, you're so pretty. So anyway, the pink stuff in the tub is actually like vegetable oil based or something. And it's got like a little bit of grit to it. So you're not supposed to like use it on glass, or I guess be careful using it on glass. But it was still seemed very, I don't know, safe to use on most surfaces. Like I was ready to use a pumice stone on this thing.
I have one of those.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't have to go that far.
All right, cool. Good to know. I'm going to buy some now. Thank you for that. Not sponsored.
I know. Well, that's the thing. I'm basically doing an infomercial for them. I did not take any befores and afters because I wasn't expecting that type of dramatic change. But yeah, you can get it anywhere. I got it on Amazon, but it's like at Target, Home Depot. It was $5.
I'm going to buy some for my toilets.
Seriously.
I'm going to pumice stone my toilets. It sucks.
Really?
If I don't swirl them once a week, then absolutely.
Huh. Interesting.
That's fun.
Well, check out the various, the pink stuff.
Atta girl.
Cleaning solutions, because holy shit. Wow.
On it, buying some this evening.
Oh, I know. I'm like, oh no, I should see if they're public and invest in stock before I start telling everybody.
Yeah. We're going to be those big name, make them go out of business. Too much demand, not enough product.
Right. Well, the funny thing is, though, you don't have to use that much.
Continue to pour it on. Just.
I'm like, okay, even if everybody went out and bought it all, like, it's going to last you because I didn't have to use that much.
One tub for two households, please. That's hilarious. I'm very excited about this finding that you have. Man. Well, I wish my girl's kind of long time coming, maybe. I ended up hanging up more pictures on Sunday. I was cleaning, and all the pictures that were hanging up or like leaning over in the bathroom area, I was like, I'm fucking just gonna hang these up now, because I was waiting for him so that we could make a joint decision. And I was like, no, I'm not waiting anymore. It's been a year. I'm just gonna put these up now. So
yeah, it's been longer than a year. So yeah. They basically were blending into the wall at that point, I'm sure.
No.
I or the floor, them. Whatever. Like,
no, I looked at it every day, like, ugh.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. But I didn't want to be disrespectful and put something on, be like, well, I didn't have him be upset. So I was like holding off. And finally, I was like, I'm breaking that barrier. We're going to shut that down, that line of thought. And we're just going to do things and ask for forgiveness now.
Mm-hmm.
So, so, like, I went upstairs to clean the bathroom. And finally, I was like, click. And I went downstairs and I grabbed the hanging stuff and I went upstairs and I started hanging and everything. And he came upstairs to ask me about something. He's like, oh, nice. Cute. And he asked me everything. I was like, yeah, that's it. Okay. I waited a whole year plus.
Yes. I was going to say, he probably does not care. No. Like, he's like, oh, that looks nice now. But
yeah. No, he cares. He does want to have an opinion. Just not everywhere. And I'm finding that. So yeah, I'm learning the ropes here. I'm proud of myself for just doing something, but also for doing something that makes me feel like it's still more of a home.
Yeah.
And continuing to do so.
Nice.
Yeah. Proud of myself.
Well, atta girl.
Thanks.
So if you guys liked what you heard today, please rate, review, subscribe. It very much helps us in the algorithms. And you can follow us on Instagram at @Homance_Chronicles. You can get Homance merch at NicoleBonneville.etsy.com. We also have a random closed group on Facebook, the Homance Chronicles, the Judgment Free Zone. And please feel free to recommend A Hoe of History by sending us like a DM or emailing us at homancepodcast@gmail.com.
Ooh, ooh.
All right.